This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Within a 24-hour period, the number of deaths globally from COVID-19 jumped from more than 315,000 to more than 318,000. The infection rate climbed to more than 4.8 million. In the United States, the death rate climbed to more than 90,000 with 1.5 million confirmed cases. Fox News Channel's Neil Cavuto urged the network's viewers not to follow President Trump, who says that he has taken an anti-malaria drug as a protection against the coronavirus. Mr. Trump made the revelation at a news conference that he had been taking the drug hydroxychloroquine to ward off the virus, despite the warnings of medical researchers that it has potential fatal side effects. Cavuto, after the news conference, called the revelation stunning. The news anchor, who suffers from multiple sclerosis, says people in vulnerable health should not follow the president's example. Cavuto's words carry weight because Fox is the network of choice for many of the president's supporters. The WHO says that it will conduct an independent evaluation of the global coronavirus response, and it will be launched as soon as possible. That is what was promised by Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus during a virtual meeting of the WHO's decision-making body, the World Health Assembly, on Monday. He added that the organization is committed to transparency, accountability, and continuous improvement. U.S. President Donald Trump has fiercely questioned the WHO's performance during the pandemic and led international criticism of China's handling of the early stages of the crisis. The review was on Monday, seemingly supported by Chinese President Xi Jinping, who had previously opposed calls for a review of the origin and spread of the novel coronavirus. This is VOA News. Britain expanded its testing scheme on Monday to allow anyone aged over 5 with COVID-19 symptoms to book a test to see if they have it. That's according to the health minister, Matt Hancock. Hancock also said the government had recruited 21,000 staff to work for its tracing system designed to find those who have had contact with someone who has the coronavirus. The expanded testing program and track and trace program are key parts of Britain's plan to move back to normalcy after a viral outbreak which has killed more than 40,000 people, according to government statistics, which includes deaths due to suspected cases. Britain has already eased some of the restrictions implemented 8 weeks ago to limit the spread of the virus, but remains on high alert in case the rate of transmission begins to rise again. If the number of cases continues to fall, Britain hopes to begin reopening schools and other parts of its shuttered economy over the coming months. Restaurant owners have given U.S. President Trump a dire accounting of the widespread damage the coronavirus pandemic has dealt to their industry and have asked him to tweak a loan program for small businesses to address their concerns. The president put a hopeful spin on their situation, saying encouraging news on vaccines and treatment efforts could negate the bad news. The president was in good spirits Monday, noting that the financial markets were up as states continue to loosen economic restrictions on businesses and following Modern Inc.'s announcement of encouraging news and early work on a vaccine development. Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Lindsey Graham is scheduling a vote that would allow him to subpoena more than 50 current and former officials who were involved in a Justice Department's investigation of Russian involvement in the 2016 U.S. presidential campaign. President Trump and his allies have launched a broad election year attack on the investigation as a deep state conspiracy. The list of people Graham wants to subpoena includes the former FBI Director James Comey, the former FBI Director, Deputy Director Andrew McCabe, and former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, as well as former CIA Director John Brennan. U.S. officials say that they have proven a link between the gunman and the deadly December attack at the Pensacola Naval Air Station and Al-Qaeda. The officials say that the gunman, a Saudi Air Force officer, was meticulous in his planning and had been radicalized overseas for at least 5 years. The gunman killed 3 U.S. sailors before he was killed by a sheriff's deputy during the rampage at a classroom building where he had been undergoing flight training. The FBI learned of the contacts between Mohammed Saeed and operatives of Al-Qaeda after breaking the encryption on cell phones that had been previously locked and that the shooter tried to destroy. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 19th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan's first vice president and his wife test positive for COVID-19.
I want to declare that I, the deputy chair of the high-level task force, has been tested and found positive. There are other members who are also tested and found positive.
President Museveni orders the wearing of face masks for all Ugandans. Zimbabwe president will today host a three-nation summit on Mozambique security. Human rights groups are concerned about election-related violence in Burundi. And Lesotho will have a new prime minister beginning today, Tuesday.
The people were already being burdened by the previous prime minister. Therefore, I think the new prime minister will have to be given the support that he deserves so that we can take the country forward.
And Human Rights Watch is concerned about extrajudicial killings in Burkina Faso. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Sudan's first vice president, Riek Machar Tein, and his wife, Angelina, who is also the country's defense minister, have tested positive for the coronavirus. South Sudan has recorded a total of 347 COVID-19 cases, including 5 deaths and 4 recoveries. Machar told state television Monday that a number of his office staff and bodyguards had also tested positive for the virus.
4 days ago, after we had found that one of our members tested positive for COVID-19. I decided that the whole task force should test because that comrade was more or less mixing up with us. So today, the Minister of Health and the Undersecretary of Health, they brought to me some of the results of the members of the task force. The members of the task force, including our guards, I want to declare that I, the deputy chair of the high-level task force, has been tested and found positive. There are other members who are also tested and found positive. I can only say at this stage that Madam Angelina Tang, the Minister of Defense and Veteran Affairs, is also found positive.
Machar also said he will self-quarantine for 14 days in his residence.
Many of the colleagues that have been found positive are in good health. Now, from now onwards, we shall be quarantining ourselves in the house, and the doctors will be visiting us until the time when they tell us it's time to unlock the quarantine. We plan that all the guards that are staying with us in the residence will also be tested so that we can contain the spread of the disease.
That was South Sudan First Vice President Riek Machar speaking to the nation Monday. Ugandan President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni says the government will now provide free face masks to all citizens as one of the measures aimed at preventing the spread of the coronavirus in the country. President Museveni says the masks will be distributed to Ugandans within 2 weeks. Mugumi Davis Rakaringi has more from Kampala.
Clad in the usual white shirt, President Museveni appeared with a face mask before addressing the nation this Monday evening. He started with applauding Ugandans for respecting the 35 measures earlier issued in mitigating the spread of COVID-19 in the country. Uganda now has 248 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in as many as over 87,000 tests, mainly truck drivers. President Museveni said Uganda has flattened the curve of the spread of coronavirus disease. He said easing the lockdown will be subjected citizens' access to face masks.
Since many people were expressing concern that they cannot afford to buy these masks, and also the government wanted to ensure quality and to ensure that people don't start borrowing masks from one another, the government has decided to provide these masks free of charge to all Ugandans of 6 years and above. We shall provide one mask per person of 6 years and above. There must be one all the time when you are in public.
Also, markets and shops will be opened, but must respect social distance measures.
Once the issue of the masks has been addressed, the shops selling general merchandise will open, provided they are not in the shopping malls they are not in the shopping arcades or food markets. We cannot allow the opening of this because it is impossible to observe the social distancing in these shopping malls or arcades. That is why they should remain closed for now. As for the markets, we should not allow the mixing of the selling of food and non-food items again until we get a vaccine or a clear treatment for this virus.
Restaurants and hotels will also be allowed to operate, but bars, saloons and gyms will remain closed. Whereas the common means of transport, motorcycles, locally known as boda-bodas, have been restricted, the president allowed other means of public and private transport, but with only 50% of passengers of the vehicle's capacity.
With education, the only possible safe action we can do now is to open for the end of educational phases candidates classes. These are the P7s, the S4s, the S6s, the undergraduate finalists, the tertiary college finalists, and the postgraduate finalists. By opening for only the candidate classes, there will be enough space in the educational premises to avoid overcrowding and observe the social distancing of 4 meters from person to person. And yet, the concerned learners will not miss that crucial stage in their educational journey.
Like in the past addresses, President Museveni said the lockdown has helped the country to be better prepared in the fight against the COVID-19 pandemic. He also said the government will plan on repatriating Ugandans stuck abroad after border crossings were closed. Mr. Museveni applauded health workers and promised to decorate them with medals for the good work done. At least 63 COVID-19 patients have since recovered and been discharged. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
In Lesotho, Dr. Mokesi Majoro is scheduled to be sworn in today, Tuesday, as the Southern African country's new prime minister. He takes over from Mbatha former prime minister Thomas Thabane. The installation comes after the Council of State, a body that advises the king on governance issues, on Monday ordered Thabane to step down. Thabane had resisted pressure from members of the ruling All Basotho Convention Party, opposition, and civil society groups to step down following his alleged involvement in the murder of his estranged wife. Max Masosa, spokesperson for the ruling ABC, tells viewers Peter Clotty that the decision of the Council of State paves the way for Lesotho to move ahead following the recent political crisis.
Yes, in terms of the agreed schedule, tomorrow he might be swearing so that on Wednesday he will be able to deal with the appointment of the cabinet ministers. That's how things were scheduled.
So, Max, what does this mean for the people of Lesotho, that they have a new prime minister beginning Tuesday?
No, actually, the people were already being thought they have been burdened by the previous prime minister. Therefore, I think the new prime minister will have to be given the support that he deserves so that we can take the country forward.
What's the significance of this latest development, a decision taken by the Council of Elders in Lesotho?
No, the significance of the decision is that there was already uncertainty of what will happen, because you also understand that now the budget should have been debated last weekend. Because of the current scenario, it didn't carry on. Therefore, this current development will enable the parliament, as it opens and reopens on Friday, 22nd. Next week, the order paper will have to be rearranged for the budget to be discussed in the parliament and be passed as such.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 19th. The Mozambican government has been at war fighting an Islamist insurgency in the country's north. The government went public about the conflict recently, but it has been going on for years, killing thousands of people and displacing thousands more. At Mozambique's request, Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa is set to host a one-day summit on the urgent security situation with the presidents of Mozambique, Zambia, and Botswana today, Tuesday. Reporter Kuzai Navashe has more.
Yusuf Adam is an academic and researcher who is an expert on gas-rich Cabo Delgado province.
At this this moment, the situation in Cabo Delgado is a situation of war and instability, where we have a group which has started a military campaign fighting against the government.
Adam says thousands of lives have been lost.
A lot of people are taken by the army or by the insurgents. They never come back. And a lot of times they find dead people in the middle of the bush. I think that now we should have about 2,000, 3,000 people dead. And we have a big number of internally displaced people.
One adage says, when elephants fight, the grass suffers. In Cabo Delgado, citizens are the grass. Both the National Army and the militants are said to dress the same, use similar weapons, and treat the masses with the same level of brutality. He puts the internally displaced numbers at over 160,000. He says they fled to more peaceful parts of the country. Some worrying reports have linked the local militants to Islamic State, with some coming from outside the country. Adam says otherwise.
At this moment, what we know from the interviews which I have done and other people have done in Cabo Delgado is that this group is composed mainly by Mozambicans. I haven't had any evidence of it, but the government says that they have been receiving help from outside. Till now, we don't have any kind of evidence about the presence of these international Islamic jihadist groups. I'm not saying they don't have contacts, so probably they have talks and so on, but till this phase, I haven't seen anything.
Adam says hunger is also a huge issue, since no one can fish or farm amid conflict. He adds that the town of Palma is also a coronavirus epicenter. While all this unfolds, the media have had challenges covering the conflict. Thomas Vieira Mario is the head of Higher Mass Media Council.
It has not been easy for the media to get there. We had some sort of a no-go zone. The official authorities would tend to block media to access there. We even had some journalists being arrested a year ago. There is some kind of blackout, but now we have been seeing the Minister of Interior and the Minister of Defense coming out to announce how the conflict is going on up there.
Still, media hasn't been able to verify the government's claims, including a statement that some 42 terrorists have been killed in the conflict. Journalist Ibrahim Abu Mbaruko hasn't been seen in more than a month. His last text to a colleague said he was surrounded by soldiers in Cabo Delgado. Adam links a government crackdown on free speech, alleged human rights violations such as torture, and a youthful population lacking the skills to work in the gas-rich province. Mercenaries have also joined the conflict amid speculation that blue-chip energy companies might be employing them to fight the militants. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinavashe from Harare.
The Burundi Human Rights Initiative is calling on the international community to pressure the government to stop the violence before the general election scheduled for Wednesday. In its report, the rights group says it has documented election-related violence aimed at thwarting opposition efforts ahead of Wednesday's polls to choose a new president, parliament, and local representatives. Tis Van Lyle, researcher for the Burundi Human Rights Initiative, tells VOA's Peter Clotty that the credibility of the polls is likely to be challenged due to what he says has been the arbitrary arrest of opposition members and escalating violence.
Indeed. So, as you know, elections are taking place in Burundi on 20 May. And what we've seen in the last months is an escalation in the violence in Burundi, in political violence. We've documented a number of killings, especially of opposition members, and we've also noticed that arrests of opposition members have rocketed in the last months, especially since the electoral campaign started. And those are all warning signs that violence could further escalate. And so we did indeed express concern and call on governments to also express that concern and take action now that it's still possible.
But some civil society groups I spoke with in Burundi say that it appears the international community isn't doing much to pressure the government or those behind the violence. What is the stance of your group about this?
Yeah, we agree that it's high time that international actors take a firm and public stance about this escalating violence. And they should do it now before the elections, because after the elections, if the violence further escalates, it will be much harder to put the brakes on such violence. So we have also written and spoken with international actors, calling upon them to issue public statements of concern that are clear in their condemnation of the political violence and in their call for accountability for the abuses that have taken place. And they should also, we think, speak directly to the main party leaders to make sure that they call on their own members to not use violence and to accept peaceful way of solving disputes.
What impact do you think the ongoing violence, if not stopped, would have on the outcome of the general election?
So we have been informed by local sources of more than 260 arrests of CNN members, and many of those people arrested are either candidates for the elections or members of that party that are supposed to observe the polls for that party. And what we've also seen is that in the last months there have been quite defiant statements by the leadership of the CNL. So all of that combined, the fact that some of their candidates, some of their members observing the elections are in prison, and that there are these defiant messages by the leadership, will increase the risk that the CNL might not accept the outcome of the elections. And they've already published a number of statements criticizing the CNE, so the Electoral Commission, for some of the decisions that the CNE has taken. There is serious doubt amongst opposition about the credibility of the CNE and about how the electoral process has been prepared up to now. So all of that combined makes it, of course, a very concerning situation for the days to come.
Tess Van Lyert is a researcher for the Burundi Human Rights Initiative. Your speaking interviewer is Peter Clotty. The Burkina Faso government has said it will open an investigation into the deaths of 12 detainees who were killed in the town of Fada Nguma shortly after their arrest on suspicion of terror offenses. Human Rights Watch Sahel director Corinne Dufcott spoke to Ricky Stryak about the ongoing extrajudicial killings by both security forces and extremists.
Well, the good news is that the government has opened an investigation, because there are so many of these incidents in which detainees are found executed shortly after being detained that are never investigated. So that's the good news. It is very concerning. I've been speaking with people who attended, who retrieved the bodies. What they say is really quite disturbing. They describe the bodies wrapped in plastic, who apparently were shot in the head. So it's extremely disturbing. And they also have expressed concern about the commander in the town in question, Tamal Bugo. So we are calling on the government to send this officer on administrative leave pending the outcome of the investigation. And, of course, for autopsies to be done on the victims to determine how they were killed, because these are clearly suspicious deaths.
Talking about the mistreatment or awful killings of people who are arrested is one thing, but also I wanted to ask your opinion on the arrest in the first place. I mean, is there a concern that the authorities are being overzealous in their arresting of people in these areas?
Well, it's a good question, and we are not in a position to say whether the suspects arrested, and there were evidently 25 of them, 12 of whom were later found dead. We're not in a position to say whether these individuals had linked to armed Islamist groups. We don't have that kind of information, and we don't take a position on that because, of course, the state is grappling with a serious problem, and there have been dozens of security force members and, of course, scores of civilians who have been killed by the armed Islamist group. So, you know, they're grappling with a serious problem here. So we don't take a position on whether or not these men, the suspects, were armed Islamists or not, or whether they had connections to them. But any suspect, according to Burkina Faso's laws and international laws, have the right to be interrogated and tried, and should not wind up, regardless of their connections, with a bullet in their head or dead in a detention cell.
Are you worried that the ongoing coronavirus pandemic is making it easier for both sides, security forces and extremist groups, to perpetrate human rights violations such as this?
You know, honestly, I have not seen an increase or decrease in these types of worrying incidents since the coronavirus hit. I don't see the relationship really, because what I think is the biggest factor here have been the devastating losses to the security forces throughout the Sahel, and that in many cases the security forces engage in reprisals against against certain communities who are believed to be supporting the armed Islamists. And here I'm talking about the Fulani or the Pul. Of course, the jihadists have concentrated their recruitment on that particular ethnic group.
That was Corinne Dufka, Human Rights Watch Sahel director. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Washington, D.C. In Malawi, the Human Rights Defenders Coalition, HRDC, has called for a nationwide protest for May 28 to force the resignation of members of the Electoral Commission, including its chairperson, Jean Ansah. National coordinator Luke Temple says Malawians no longer have confidence in Justice Ansah and her commission to preside over another election. The country's high courts have ruled that the May 29th election, in which President Arthur Peter Mutharika was re-elected, was filled with irregularities. A new election is set for July 2nd this year.
Basically, the purpose of the 28th May demonstrations is to push Jean Ansah out of the Malawi Electoral Commission. We are calling this the last push. We are not going to stop. For as long as she is holding that position, we are going to employ every strategy at our disposal to make sure that she steps down from the chairpersonship of the Malawi Electoral Commission. So basically the main purpose is to remind her that we don't have trust in her and her fellow commissioners, so that she can pave way for new people who would have trust of Malawians to manage the forthcoming presidential elections.
Justice Jean Ansah has said that she and her fellow commissioners, their term of service is expected to finish at the end of June this year. So why not just wait for their term to expire?
Unfortunately, we don't have the luxury of time to wait until when the contracts expire on 2nd of June. As you are aware, we're running against time. The elections are only in July, and each passing day is very precious to us to make sure that we've got commissioners that Malawians can trust. You remember, over the past 9-10 months, they have been saying that we are waiting for the determination of the court. And today they are saying they are waiting for their contracts to expire. We can't trust them.
Why can't you go, say, to the court? After all, it was the court that ordered the special election.
Of course, we've employed different strategies to make sure that she steps down. For your own information, we instructed our lawyers to write Jane Ansah a letter, which was written last week, asking her to step down, failing which would seek the interpretation of the same through the courts. We gave her a deadline of 15th May to resign, which I think was last week Friday.
Luke Temple is the national coordinator of the Malawi Human Rights Defenders Coalition. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. And that's it for this Tuesday, May 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers. I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a great day.